Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Brian Chan, and he'll be answering your most important questions on the secrets of chironomids. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Brian a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Brian Chan about the secrets of chironomids. Our approach is simple, education. Fly Fusion is unique when it comes to fly fishing magazines. It is one of only a few magazines in North America that focuses on instruction and education. In Fly Fusion, we've covered subjects like short-line nymphing, tactics for tough days, stillwater fly patterns, dry fly fishing for fussy trout, and a host of other interesting and educational topics. Visit our website today at www.flyfusionmag.com. That's www.flyfusionmag.com. And start your subscription to Fly Fusion today so that you can learn all you need to know about fly fishing. Before we introduce Brian, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away 1-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have 2 chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Brian's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Brian's book, Morris and Chan on Fly Fishing Trout Lakes. Now, thanks to Brian for offering this as a prize tonight. And here's how you can win this book. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something we talk about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and your location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, and maybe you'll win Brian's book. Tonight, our guest is Brian Chan. Brian has been an avid stillwater fly fisher and fly tire for over 35 years. He is a professional fisheries biologist who, for the past 30 years, managed small lake recreation fisheries, as well as promoting and marketing freshwater fishing in the province of British Columbia. Brian is also a fishing author, video producer, lecturer, and angling guide. Some of his more recent works include the books Morris and Chan on Fly Fishing Trout Lakes, Stillwater Solution Recipes, 30 Proven Patterns, by Brian Chan, and Phil Rowley and the DVD Expert Techniques for Stillwater Fly Fishing. He's also a regular contributor to several fly fishing magazine publications, and he's also a regular guest on several TV fishing shows, a co-host of the New Fly Fisher Show. Brian's favorite fishing haunts are the many trout lakes surrounding his home city of Kamloops, but he can often be found wading rivers in other provinces and states, as well as making forays into the Northwest Territories in the Yukon for big lake trout and pike. Brian has a number of professional fly fishing industry affiliations, including Sage, Mustad, Rio, Islander, Superfly, and Outcast Sporting Gear. Brian, thanks for joining us, and welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Yeah, it's great to be back, Roger.
Well, we had a wonderful time the last time we chatted. In fact, we had to have 2 shows cover all the questions that came in, and so that was quite exciting, and we covered a lot of ground, but tonight we're going to really just focus on the chironomids, which is something that you've spent a lot of time with, right?
No, it's certainly my favorite form of fishing still waters, and it's also extremely productive.
Well, that's what everybody likes, that word productive, don't they? We all like to catch fish, right?
Betcha.
Yeah. So let's talk about chironomids, and first let's just, you know, talk about what they are. So what is a chironomid?
So chironomids are members of the insect order Diptera, or two-winged. They're true flies, and in the adult stage they have 2 wings. And so they're in a large order that includes other common insects such as mosquitoes or crane flies, black flies, and other midges. And chironomids are a large family, There's literally over a couple thousand different species in North American waters. They're not just confined to living in lakes. They're certainly very prominent in rivers, in brackish water, and so slightly salted water, they'll be in there as well. And they're found, they'll be living in the aquatic environment almost anywhere you go in the world, you can find chironomids.
Yeah, I noticed just scanning questions tonight, we got some questions from, I believe, over in the UK. So, Ireland, and so, yeah, it looks like they are everywhere. And so you said several thousand of types of chironomids. And, you know, what is their life cycle, and how is that important to us as anglers? And we're going to be speaking primarily around about lakes, still waters tonight, right?
Yeah, certainly. And the reason why they're, you know, chironomids and lakes are such a valuable insect food source to learn and to be able to fish is that they get quite large. The different species can grow to very big sizes in still waters compared to moving waters. And so for us up in Canada, in Western Canada, it's not uncommon to see chironomid larvae and pupa that are pushing over 3/4 of an inch in length in the larval pupa and the adult stage. So they become a very big food source. And the fact that there's so many of them in the water column living in these lakes and rivers that their emergences are large and they can become a very valuable food source just for that reason alone. And their life cycle in lakes is similar to anywhere in the world. They have a complete metamorphosis. They go from an egg to a larva to a pupa to an adult stage. Trout will feed on a larval pupal and the adult stage. And depending on the species, chironomid larvae can live for up to 2 years in the larval stage before they're ready to pupate and emerge as the adult. And so chironomid larvae can be a very important food source at basically all times of the year because there are larvae existing in those lakes 365 days of the year. So with the complete metamorphosis, the adult chironomid will return, female chironomid with fertilized eggs will return to the lake usually late in the evening, early in the morning, you know, hover and fly over the surface of the lake, the tip of her abdomen in the water, and release eggs which sink to the bottom of the lake. And those eggs will typically hatch within a couple weeks into a very almost microscopic free-swimming larval stage, which settles on the bottom of the lake and in most cases forms a cocoon-like case or a larval tube that they live in at the mud-water interface at the bottom of the lake. So larvae can be living at the bottom of the lake in 5 feet of water or 20 feet of water or 75 feet of water. And the larvae poke their heads out of these little tubes that they build and feed mainly on detritus, decomposing vegetation, but they'll eat other animal matter as well. So they're kind of omnivorous. They don't do a lot of poking around or coming out of their tubes because they're not very, the larva cannot swim very well. They can kind of just wiggle and twitch through the water, so they're pretty vulnerable. But the trout do love to search them out and eat them while they're in their larval tube. When the chironomid larva is fully developed, it'll seal itself inside its larval tube and transform from that segmented worm-like larva into the chironomid pupa stage inside the tube, typically at the bottom of the lake. When the larva is fully developed, and that could take a couple weeks, the pupae, will then break out of the old larval tube and wiggle itself to the surface of the lake to emerge as the adult. And to get that pupa to the surface of the lake, its metabolism, its body secretes gases which line the inside of the outer shuck of the, or cuticle of the pupa, and it gives it a shiny or mirror-like appearance of that trap gas which helps elevate the pupa to the surface of the lake. And once the pupa reaches the surface of the lake, a split will break open on the back of the thorax, and the adult stage of the chironomid will emerge, dry its wings off, fly to shore, and then typically mating occurs that evening, and then the adults are coming back either that evening or the next morning to renew the life cycle.
And then they die.
By far the largest number of chironomid species, their larval stage they do build these larval tubes at the bottom of the lake. However, there are chironomid larval species, and that the larvae is more free-swimming, hiding in and amongst the benthic vegetation in the lakes as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you say it's only a matter of a few days from when they go to larva to pupa to adult?
Well, the maturation of the larva to the pupa stage can take a couple weeks, and then when the actual emergence of the pupa to the surface of the lake, it happens in minutes, most often.
So they go from pupa to adult in minutes, huh?
Yeah, but there are instances where the chironomid pupa will emerge from the larval cases, and they'll suspend at the bottom of the lake, waiting perhaps to finish final development or water temperature, right? Something in the development stage is not perfect, and they suspend at the bottom. It could be for several days before they ascend to the surface of the lake. That's why many anglers ask questions, well, you know, we had great chironomid pupa fishing and never saw an adult, and that's because the pupa were staged at the bottom of the lake and just not ready to emerge. But the trout don't know that, and they see them stacked at the bottom there, and they gorge on them.
So, and we'll talk more about this here in a few minutes, I think, but it looks like there's a couple of opportunities, or three opportunities for us to fish the different life cycles.
You betcha.
Yeah. Now, so is this, in your area, it sounds like this might be a dominant food source in the Stillwaters, or is it?
Oh, certainly in Western Stillwaters, and that's Western Canada, Western United States, and certainly in the UK, and in other parts of Europe, and in New Zealand, for sure. I mean, they are a very prominent food source. The more productive the water body, meaning the more nutrients it has in the lake, the more abundant you'll see diversity and preference of chironomid larvae and pupa and adults as food source. So they're found everywhere. They're definitely extremely productive in very, very nutrient-rich trout lakes, which are classified as eutrophic lakes. They're very shallow, have minimal inlets and outlets, or are landlocked, and have a lot of shoal area, and are rich in their water chemistry. And those are the lakes that will have the most abundant and diverse populations of chironomids.
Now, when you say shallow, what is shallow to you?
So, typically, a typical very productive chironomid lake may have, could be 100 acres in surface area, could be 200 acres, but the maximum depth might be 30 feet, and okay, the average depth of that lake might be 12 feet. So we have what we call a lot of shoal or littoral zone in the lake, which provides ideal habitat for many, many aquatic trout food sources, but in particular for chironomids.
Okay. We had a question from Chuck Kaminsky in Oklahoma, and he writes in and says, there is much commonality between chironomids that live in still waters and those that live in moving waters.
The common theme between the two is that the larvae in a river could potentially be, if it's a slow-moving river, or in the slower sections of the rivers, like in the pools or flats, the larvae, depending on the species, could be living in the mud-water interface, or the larvae could be free-swimming. And that's the same that can occur in lakes as well. The pupation is the same, and the emergence, the pupa rising to the surface of the lake or the river, is the same, although in a river you're going to have the effects of current causing insect drift, and a chironomid pupa will be drifting downriver as they're trying to emergent or wiggle up to the surface of the lake to emerge. And then the adults come back, same way as they do in lakes and rivers, release eggs that are demersal, that sink to the bottom of the lake or the river, and begin the life cycle again.
Okay, and I think you did mention earlier that you find that the chironomids in lakes tend to be larger in size than on the rivers.
I know
the midges down on the San Juan River in New Mexico pride themselves on being tiny.
that's certainly the case, where the chironomid species in standing or still waters are significantly larger than in rivers. And it's also true that the further north you go in latitude, the bigger you tend to see chironomid pupa fishing. For instance, in my home waters in the interior of British Columbia, we're regularly fishing chironomid pupa tied on 14, 12s, 10s, 8s, and even 6 size 6 scud hooks, which are monstrous. If you're talking to someone that's fishing at tailwater in southern Montana or, you know, the San Juan River in New Mexico. So they can be quite large. And again, that's why in lakes they can be such a valuable food source.
Now, and I think I may have used the word midge just a minute ago, but is chironomid synonymous with midge?
Yeah, we use them midges, chironomid midges, buzzers, all used to mean represent the same insects that we're talking about, just different areas of the world use different terminology.
Okay. Randy in Tennessee writes in, Brian, with your biology background, can you give us any tips on how chironomids move about or if they move at all? Should they be fished differently in still water than in rivers or streams?
Yeah. So in lakes, I think Randy's talking about a pupa, and the pupa are rising vertically or ascending to the surface of the lake. Now, they could be ascending from 65 feet or 6 feet, and if they're at 65 feet, that's a long journey to the surface of the lake. So they do a lot of wiggling as they get usually in the top fifth of their migration. When they're on the upper fifth of their migration, they can start twitching around a fair bit, and just in an attempt to start freeing the future adult from the pupal shock, and they get to the surface lake, and then that's how, because they pop out so quickly, that's what gets them out so quickly. And so there's a fair bit of movement, but overall, we're fishing chironomid pupa patterns in still waters dead slow, because they're static, it's suspended at a particular depth, or just moving them very slowly or retrieving them very slowly up through the water column. In a river situation, because there's current, you're also going to be fishing these pupa dead drift because they're just slowly drifting with the current and slowly moving up through the water column until they get to the surface of the river. So I think it's safe to say that regardless of whether you're in a river or a lake, you're not going to be stripping in chironomid pupa patterns quickly.
Right,
they're at the grace of currents or with the gas bubbles in lakes to rise slowly up through the water column.
And, of course, like you mentioned earlier, with when you're working in rivers or streams, then you've got the drift, and so you're primarily doing nymph fishing with dead drift techniques in most cases. Okay, we need to take a quick break here, Brian, but when we come back, we'll talk with you more about chironomids and how we might fish them and be more productive.
Sounds good.
Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. They have an extensive inventory and fly tying department and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com. That's K-I-E-N-E.com. Or call Keeney's Fly Shop at 1-800-400-0359. That's 1-800-400-0359. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Brian Chan about the secrets of chironomids. If you'd like to ask Brian a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Brian, what's been happening in your fly fishing world since I talked to you last? What are you up to?
Well, still doing writing and doing a lot of hosting or co-hosting TV shows, fly fishing shows, and keeping busy doing that and some guiding at, on the local lakes in and around the Kamloops area. And, you know, right now I just put the boat away the other day. It's winter here and the lakes are freezing over, so get a bit of a break from fishing the lakes and it's time to go skiing.
Time to go skiing. Yeah. They have been twice already. Not downhill yet, but cross country a couple times.
So. Yeah, that's what we're waiting for.
Yeah. So I hear you. And what about, you know, we mentioned your books you've published and so forth. Where can people find out more about the books you've published and the services you offer and so forth?
Yeah, they can certainly visit my website, riseformflyfishing.com, and get a lot of information off there on what I'm up to, some of the products I have. And they've also information about fishing tactics and pretty good entomology section there as well on the short bugs that we fish.
So that's riseformfishing.com.
Riseformflyfishing.com.
Oh, I'm sorry. Riseformflyfishing.com. Okay. Just want to make sure everybody got that. Well, good, good. And it looks like we're getting some questions now in on the Internet. Mark in Arvada, Colorado, requests that you please give some examples of adult chironomids He's looking for, I think, more common term names like mosquito, gnat.
For patterns, yeah. So really the one we use up here, the one I use the most is actually a pattern that I developed a number of years ago called the Lady McConnell. And it's a deer hair shellback, very simple fly with some grizzly hackle and the tip of a grizzly dry fly hackle for a tail with some Z-line, gray Z-line out the back. And it just imitates, it rides low on the water, and it imitates both an emerger chronomid just sitting in the surface film. And if you add a little ging to it, it'll float a little higher, and they'll take it for the adult. I think you get away with Griffith's gnats, and you can even get away with things like small parachute atoms. The trick with the adults is that when the adults are laying eggs, you know, they're skimming across the surface lake, so you want to impart some movement to that adult pattern by stripping it in 6 to 9 inch slow pulls to make a V wake. And oftentimes when the fish are eating adults, they'll track, and you can see them tracking, and fish will take one adult here, be swimming from left to right, take another one 10 feet away, and you can anticipate where that fish is going to come up next and put a fly across perpendicular to his direction of travel and put it across his face and strip it across his line of sight, and usually I can get a reaction to that.
Mm-hmm. I think what Mark was after, though, was more common term names of the bugs. I could be wrong, and maybe he was looking for adult patterns, but when we think of chronomids and common term names, are we talking about gnats? Or are mosquitoes a chronomid?
It's midges is the most, or buzzers in Europe, or chronomids over here. And midges is typically more common name in the States, and we call them chronomids up here in Canada.
Yeah, okay. We did get a question here from Dave. He says, I often see, I guess it's the chow borus, or Geobris. The glass worm. Geobris?
Yep.
Or I guess it's also known as glassworm in throat samples. How are they different than chronomids, and is there a good pattern for them? Are they in some lakes more than others?
So what Dave's referring to are, they're called chaobris, and or glassworms or phantom midges. They're midges. They're still members of the different family. The difference between a chaobris and a chronomid is that the chaobris larva is free-swimming, and larvae is clear. It's like a clear piece of spaghetti in the water, up, you know, half an inch to 5/8 of an inch in length, with little black kind of buoyancy chambers at either end of its body. And they swim or situate themselves like a submarine in the water. They're horizontal in the water, and they go up and down in the water column. These chaobris larvae are meat eaters, and they prey on zooplankton, like Daphnia or Cyclops or Buzzmina, and the Daphnia moves up and down in the water column because they're photosensitive, so they're down lower during daytime and then rise up in low light conditions. So zooplankton are those little black or green, black or red, orange dots you see bopping around in the water. That's what the chaobris larvae feed on. So this is a clear, transparent bug with a black dot at either end, extremely difficult to imitate. Unfortunately, trout will gorge on them. Oftentimes, they prefer to eat them in the warm summer months when there's not a lot of other food sources or insects hatching. And that can be very challenging to imitate, which I think it's almost impossible to imitate. Some anglers have a success on patterns on long shanked hooks, you know, like 12s or 14, 2X, 3 extra long, even 10, 2 extra long with clear glass beads or clear mono wrap or using monofilament to try to imitate them. And there is some success on them, and some guys have done actually well on them, but I've found it could be a pretty challenging food source to imitate. My take on it is when I do a throw pump of a fish and it's full of chaobris larvae, then I'll be presenting them some bead-headed, woolly bugger, very flashy maroon-red type leech patterns, stripping them through the water column quickly to get in sight of very aggressive take by fish that want to chase them out of their feeding zone. So that can be a challenging, certainly, life stage to imitate. Now, the chaobris larvae, when it pupates, it turns into a chaobris pupa, that are often pale, watery green abdomens and then a brown thorax. and they do not have white gills, to which chronomid pupa have. So when you do a throat pump and you get Chiabra's pupa, they almost look more like a mosquito pupa, but their little ears, they've got little two pointed ears that come up. Their gills are pointed, and they don't have white gills. They're just brown. And then you know you've got Chiabra's pupa, and you can successfully imitate a Chiabra's pupa by tying patterns that are typically olive, apple, green olive, to dark green olive with brown thoraxes, and fish them the same way you would with the pupa.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I think there's probably, I've seen Chiabra's in almost every lake that I fished. They may be more abundant in some lakes, but I don't know. I'm not aware of any circumstances that dictate that you'd see more in one lake and not the other.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about, we'll come back to chronomids and fly patterns and so forth here in a little bit, but let's talk a little bit about the equipment you're using to fish still waters with chronomids. Martin Coleman, Lawrence, Kansas, writes in, would you talk about the different lines available and your preferences when fishing still waters and chronomids? And maybe you can combine that with the size and weight rods you prefer to use for chronomids.
Sure. Yeah, you bet. Basically, you can make it fairly simple. Three basic lines that I would have in the boat when you're fishing chronomids. The first one would be a full floating line so that you can present pupil patterns with or without a strike indicator. So you can either suspend them under an indicator or fish a long leader and awaited patterns and get them down to the close to the bottom where you're going to be doing most of your fishing. A second line that's very effective for chronomids is an intermediate sinking line, the real Camolux or a real Aqualux. Those lines, you can let the lines do the sinking for you. And those lines can be quite effective when you're fishing in water 15 to 22, 23 feet in depth. And you can cast out with your pupil pattern, wait for that fly to get down to the bottom, and then using a slow hand retrieve, you can retrieve that fly, that pupil pattern, through any potential feeding zones that the fish may be in. And oftentimes I recommend anglers using that, the intermediate sinking lines, if they're uncomfortable casting with long leaders and floating lines. Let the sinking line do the sinking for you. And the third line that really should be in every fly vest or fly tackle bag is a type 6 or a type 7, like the real deep 7 full sinking line. And that's type 7 is about as fast as you can get and allows you to fish chronomids in a vertical presentation. In a situation, perhaps, if you're fishing, there's an emergence coming off in 30 feet of water, 45, 50, 60 feet of water, you can let that full sinking line sink at 7 inches per second, get that pupa pattern or patterns right to the bottom of the lake, and then use a very slow hand twist or very, very slow strip retrieve, bringing that pupa pattern up through the water column, just like the real ones are doing. I think overall, though, by far the majority of chronomid pupal fishing and chronomid larva fishing, it's going to be done with a full floating line. And there's certainly lines made by the various fly line manufacturers that are designed to help you cast indicators, because indicators can be a bit clumsy chucking them out there, and lines are now been designed to have that short front but heavy taper to help you turn your flies over and get those indicators out there. As far as rods go, certainly with floating lines, 9.5 to 10 foot, and I prefer the 10-footers, and for that floating line and fishing those long leaders, the longer the rod you got, the more leverage you have. And particularly if you're fishing out of a float tube or a pontoon boat, it just gives you that more reach and makes it easier to get those long casts out there. We're not doing real tight loops and double hauling. We're kind of lobbing things out there to make sure everything lays out properly. And that 9.5, 10-foot rods are great for that. And, you know, line weight, rod weight systems, 5-6 is what I prefer, a 5-weight or a 6-weight. And many anglers like a 7-weight. As long as you've got a system, depending on the waters you fish, if they're going to be consistently windy all the time, if you're fishing a lot, or if you're just fishing a lot of windy days, then a 6-weight system might be a little more easier to handle and to cast than a 5-weight system. And if it's calm water you're fishing a lot or small lakes, a 4-weight system would be great as well.
Okay. Okay. Omar, Canyon City, Colorado, says, do you think Stillwater Chronomid Fishing deserve dedicated specialty line setups? He's referring to camo sinking and camo floating, as opposed to your regular moving water lines that you already own. So
I think that, you know, we've covered off that full floating line, and then certainly the camo sinking or a Camolux or a Aqualux or Cortland has a camouflage clear taper, clear sinking line as well. They're great. They're slow sinking, intermediate sinking that you're going to use in both rivers and lakes, and certainly you need to use your floating line in rivers and lakes. And you could even be using that Type 7 in a river situation as well. And so many anglers that are set up for river fishing are going to be fine equipment over the lakes.
So Rick Takahashi, who I think you know, Fort Collins, Colorado, writes in and asks how you set up your riggings when fishing for chronomids. And I'm assuming he's talking about, you know, the terminal tackle after we leave the line and what goes on down below there.
Yeah, well, we're in a bit of a unique situation in British Columbia in terms of we're restricted to using only one fly. So we can't fish droppers, you know, multiple flies, which you can in most other jurisdictions. So, you know, in BC, we've kind of developed, a system that works well based on having just one fly down there. And certainly the most common way that we're fishing chronomid pupa here is with a floating line and with a strike indicator. And I like to use a barrel swivel in sizes 12, 14, 16, and I like to put that swivel about 18 to 24 inches above the chronomid pupa pattern that I'm fishing. So I've tied in this barrel swivel onto the leader with an improved clinch knot and then tied my piece of fluorocarbon, that last tippet section that's 18 to 24 inches long with an improved clinch knot, to the other end of the swivel. And then I'm tying my chronomid on with a non-slip loop knot, which is critical, I believe, to catching a lot more fish. Using a non-slip loop knot allows your any fly fish subsurface in rivers and lakes. It allows them to swim more naturally, provide more undulating motion to those chronomid pupa, particularly when they're suspended under an indicator and your indicator is bobbing up and down in a slight breeze. It just makes those flies stand out that much more, and fish are going to see them quicker. And I don't use a fluorocarbon leader right through the whole system. I typically use a 10-foot indicator leader that Rio makes, ending in, so it's a 10-foot indicator. It has a 3-foot butt section that's been dyed a bright orange color so you can see it in the water. But what I like about those leaders is that they have a 3-foot butt section that it's only 3 feet long, and then it tapers right down to either straight 7 feet of 3X or 4X or 5X. And my typical situation would be I'd be tying on a loop-to-loop on the end of my floating line up an indicator leader that ends in 4X, tying on more 4X to get me to within a couple feet of the bottom, and then I'll tie my swivel on, and then I'll use fluorocarbon, usually 4X or 5X fluorocarbon to the pupa pattern. The lakes we fish in BC, in other parts of Western Canada and Eastern Washington, Oregon, you rarely have to go down below 5X because the good fluorocarbons are such fine diameter these days. You can get away with a lot of fishing with 4X fluorocarbon tippet.
When you're talking about a barrel swivel, can you describe that? Last time I heard swivels used was, when I was spin fishing. So,
that's what they are. They're for keeping the twist out of your line. And so they're just, Mustad makes a wide selection of swivels, and a lot of other companies make different sizes. And it's just basically, the swivels do three things for us. They add weight. It gets your fly down to the bottom quicker, so you get into the feeding zone quicker. They add a bit of flash to when you're fishing. So remember, when this is just speaking about fishing in British Columbia waters, we'll fish gray swivels or gunmetal gray ones. We'll fish black ones. We'll fish silver ones. We'll fish gold ones. And actually, the fish, if you get a bite and you miss the fish more than once, chances are, or you hook a fish and it's foul hooked, you swivel. And it's telling you that you probably want to change the color of your pupa because that's not the color they want. So you can actually use that. The swivel becomes a bit of a color selector and size selector for you as well. But the third thing swivels do is that when you're fishing with indicators and it gets fairly choppy out there, by putting a heavier swivel on, it'll reduce the bounce so that your pupil pattern isn't bouncing up and down in the water column too abruptly and looking too unnatural. And that, so I carry those, all those, as I mentioned earlier, three different weights or sizes of swivels. And the smaller, the bigger the number on the swivel, like a 16 swivel, the smaller it is. So 12s, 14s, and 16s in swivels are what we typically use. Now, if you're fishing in waters that where you can use multiple flies, and you could be, I definitely would be fishing at least two Cronomid pupil patterns and switching size and color till I dialed into the right one. And those can be tied on. You can have one tied on to you at the end of your tippet with loop knot, and then you can tie directly to the bend of the hook with an improved clinch knot and have your second Cronomid hanging down another 16 inches, again on fluorocarbon, and tied on with another non-slip loop knot. Or you could tie on your one fly, and then above it at another tippet knot, you can tie on with a perfection loop, 8-inch piece of tippet two, and just let it sit above the last tippet knot, and then tie your second Cronomid to that little 8-inch piece of tippet that's hanging out the side, and that can be quite effective as well.
Okay. We need to take a quick break, but come back. We'll talk more about the secrets of Cronomids. Royal Gorge Anglers is a full-service fly shop on the Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. They provide both walk, wade, and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas, South Platte, and several private high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to assure that everyone taking a trip leaves being a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Royal Gorge Anglers, the gateway to Southern Colorado. Located conveniently on U.S. 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. For more information, visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's www.royalgorgeanglers.com. Or call them at 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Brian Chan about the secrets of Cronomids. If you'd like to ask Brian a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Brian. Now, in that whole conversation, you never mentioned anything about weight. So is the only weight that we've got in there that swivel and the flies?
Well, that's what we use. And, of course, we're also using a lot of bead-headed Cronomids. So,
okay.
Copper, tungsten, just tungsten bead heads, white metal bead heads, or you can use silver, glass beads as well. Other anglers like to use split shot or putty, non-lead putty that you can wrap around a tippet knot to help to get your fly down as well. So there's various ways of getting down there. We just find swivel does that and a few other things for you.
Okay. Now, this is the same technique that whether we're fishing with larva or pupa, are we using the same kind of rig here? Okay.
Yeah, you do the same setup if we're fishing the pupa. So I should just back up one step and just explain, because this might answer some people that might be scratching their head. So if in a typical Cronomid pupal migration situation, it's 17 feet deep, and there's all kinds of pupa coming up through the water column, and you know that because you can see the adults on the water. You can look into the water and see pupa wiggling up. You see the spent shucks of the emerged adults. You see the swallows and nighthawks or Bonaparte gulls or other gulls feeding on the adults. So you know something's happening there. You double anchor your boat. You know it's 17 feet deep because you've got a depth sounder, which is critical for fishing lakes. You need to know the depth you're in. You know it's 17 feet deep, so you rig up your 10-foot, 5-weight rod, your full floating line. You've got your indicator on it, and you have to be able to have at least, you got to have at least, 17 feet below that indicator. You don't need that much, but you need to be hanging, start fishing your Cronomid pupal patterns within about 8 to 12 inches of the bottom of the lake. So at 17 feet deep, we want to have our Cronomid at 16 feet. So it's a foot off the bottom. And if you're fishing where you can have more than one Cronomid, your second one would be 12 to 18 inches above the first chronomid, because if it's 17 feet deep, in many, many situations, the trout are more comfortable feeding on the pupa close to the bottom of the lake rather than higher in the water column. And this is especially so in very clear water lakes, where the higher in the water column trout are feeding in general, the more they expose themselves to avian predators like ospreys and loons. So it's just safer to eat your meals closer to the bottom. And with chronomids, that means getting them to within about a foot of the bottom of the lake. That's where I would start fishing.
Okay, okay. Now, so that kind of begs the question, how do we know they're feeding on chronomids at the bottom rather than other types of insects in shallower water? Because we're always taught, you know, in lakes to fish the shells, the feed beds, the structure where we fight damsels or something else going on.
You bet. And it's all about hatches. It's all about insect emergences. If it's in prime time, late spring, and you know there's chronomids going to be coming off, that's the time of year they come off. Water temperatures are conducive to insect emergences, then the trout are going to be looking for them. If it's a non-hatch situation, the trout will go back to bread-and-butter food sources like scuds or shrimp, or hunt down immature dragonfly nymphs or immature damselfly nymphs or mayfly nymphs. But when there's an actual emergence, and there's lots, as I just mentioned, there's lots of visible clues that tells you there's a chronomid hatch emerging, or if it was a mayfly hatch or a damselfly or a caddisfly hatch, you know, there's lots of clues out there that let us know that something's going on. And the trout are opportunistic feeders, and they grab onto what's hatching, because typically it's going to be a lot of food sources in the water. A lot of those chronomid pupa, or could be mayfly hatch or whatever, there's a heavy concentration of them moving, migrating, or swimming, or emerge, or rising up to the water column, so they become an easy meal for those opportunistic feeders.
Is there anything that goes on with these larvae when they're down there and they're turned into pupa and they're ready to emerge? Is it all have to do with water temperature and conditions, or is there any kind of communication between them down there that we know of? Say, hey, it's time to do it.
I wish I could answer that one. I think as anglers, we have, and we certainly know that what drives insect development, or anything in lakes in general, the biology of lakes, is water temperature. And I think it's very safe to say that once the surface temperatures of a lake in the early spring, once they get above 46, 47 degrees Fahrenheit, you know the water at the bottom of the lake, or in particular the bottom of the shoals, is going to be getting warm enough for those first chronomid hatches or midge hatches of the year to occur. Once surface temperatures get, you know, above 50 Fahrenheit, or 10 degrees Celsius, between 50 and 65 degrees Fahrenheit, you're going to see a lot of insect hatches. And the first insect hatches that occur every year are always chronomids or midges. And those are followed by mayflies, which are followed by damselflies and caddisflies, and then dragonflies. So at the spring of the year, early in the year, the first hatches of the year will be chronomids or midges. Always, that's just always the case, and they're always followed by mayflies. Now, if it was late spring, early summer, you could easily see chronomids, mayflies, damselflies all hatching or all emerging on the same day. And that's when things get a little more complicated, because trout will switch from one food source to the other. And it's no different than you can have on in this prime spring chronomid season. It's very easy to have two or more, maybe three, four different species of chronomids coming off in the same day. So now we've got three or four different sizes and colors of pupa emerging at the same time. And trout are not colorblind, and they'll switch from one color to the next, or from a small one to a big one. And by being observant and looking in the water, and by judiciously using a throat pump, you can sample fish of adequate size, non-lethally, sample what they've been feeding, what's in their throat, what they've just recently put down the throat, because it's all going to be live, and you can actually track the change in feeding behavior of fish during the day.
Now, you just said, you know, you could have several different species coming off at once. And then, so I'm assuming that, you know, the spring midget or chronomids and the ones that you might find in August or September are going to be probably different species coming off because they're triggered by different water temperatures or year or time or?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In the waters we fish in the midsummer, typically in many lakes that I fish, the midsummer hatches are often very, very large pupa. The species are quite large. We call them bombers. They get that big, and they're upwards of 5/8, 3/4 of an inch in length as a pupa, and it's a big food source. Those typically come off midsummer months. They don't come off. They're not found in every lake, but they're found in a lot of lakes.
Okay. Kelly in Idaho wrote in and asked about if you use breakaway indicators for your still fishing, and if so, what's the best method success using these types of indicators?
Yeah, I think Kelly's referring to quick-release indicators. So quick-release indicators are those indicators that you set. They have a peg, and you thread your tippet through the peg, and then you make a little loop and then snug that little peg into the indicator. And when you hook a fish, peg trips, releases, and the indicator and peg slide down your line. Those indicators were designed for fishing deeper water, because if you were fishing in 15 feet of water and you had a fixed indicator, like pegged with a toothpick at 14 feet, and you hook the fish of a lifetime, you can't get that fish close enough to the boat to land unless you had a really, really long landing net. So what you'd have to do is someone's going to have to grab your leader, grab that indicator, pull that pin out so the indicator will slide down, because you're never going to get the fish close enough to the boat. And when we start grabbing indicators and fish are pulling, that's when things happen. Messes, ugly break-offs, where fish starts to run, the natural instinct is to grab on and hit that indicator and stop them from running, and you break them off. So the quick-release indicators or breakaway indicators just allow you to fish that deeper water. And I like to use quick-release indicators when I'm fishing in water more than about 12 feet in depth.
Is there a particular company that makes those, or are they available?
There are several of them. My good fishing friend, Phil Rowley, has a series of indicators in Canada that quick-release indicators, and there are several manufacturers that make those quick-release indicators now.
Okay, okay. Brian in Ontario, Canada, writes in, and he says, most of our rainbow lakes where I live are quite deep with clear water. The lakes are 50 to 120 feet deep. Those can be at the bottom or anywhere in between. I fish from a float tube. What would be the best setup to fish chronomids? He's talking about leader, line type, swivel, and fly type. Is what you've just described the same approach he should be using?
Well, certainly in, I mean, they could be between 1,500 and 20 feet maximum depth, but there's obviously going to be some shallow water. Mm-hmm. And you have to match your fishing technique with the depth range or the depth zone that the chronomids are hatching. So if Brian went out and paddled out in his float tube and saw birds working out in 45 feet of water, he gets out there, and there's all kinds of chronomid shucks on the water, then my first technique to employ would be to, first of all, put my anchor down, and then I'd take out that deep 7, type 7 line, and I'd cast out a pupil pattern representative of what's coming off, exactly 45 feet, or a 45-foot-long cast, let it sink so it's vertical, straight up and down, and then employ a very slow but steady hand-twist retrieve, bringing that fly up from 45 feet to the surface of the lake.
All the way to the top, and then do it again.
Right to the top, because that's how those bugs are coming up. They got to come up to the top tack. And what will typically happen is you'll get bites within several feet of the bottom of the lake, and then there'll be quite a distance where you won't get any bites, or you'll get your bites within 15, 20 feet, or 12 to 20 feet of the surface of the lake. And the fish will follow the fly up all the way from the bottom and grab it when it gets close to the surface, because it's now a fleeing food source. Mm-hmm. And they grab it before it escapes. Mm-hmm. So you could make 3 or 4 casts with that deep 7 line, get a bite on every cast, and you know the fly's only 12 feet below the surface lake when you get the bite. And so you take out your floating line and suspend a chronomid pupa 12 feet under an indicator and hang it out there. And you won't get a bite, because there's no fish staying at that depth. They're all down below, and they follow the fly up.
Follow it up. Okay.
Again, it's all about where those fish want to eat the pupal pattern or their live, the real pupa, in relation to the bottom of the lake. And more often than not, it's closer to the bottom than higher in the water column.
So you got to find that sweet spot.
Exactly. Yeah. You start at the bottom, a foot off the bottom, and then if you're fishing with indicators or with floating lines and long leaders, you start presenting close to the foot of the bottom. If you're not getting fish, you slowly start working in 1 foot increments up higher off the bottom. In many Pacific Western states, in the Pacific, North Pacific states and provinces, fish do like to eat them closer to the bottom.
Okay. We got some questions coming in here on the internet, so let me address a few of these. Roger in Carlsbad asks, do chronomids species include the mosquito? And does the appearance of high numbers of chronomids in a body of water indicate a less suitable environment for cold water fish?
So no, so chronomids are separate family from mosquitoes, so we're not talking about them at all. And, you know, if you have a lot of chronomids in a water body, I'd say you're probably fishing a very productive piece of water, and it should be prime habitat for cold water species like trout. I guess if you're fishing a very, very shallow lake and you're more southern in latitude and it had a huge chronomid population, you may be getting out of the range where cold water species like trout and char are comfortable, and you might be getting into a situation where there's more warm water species in there. And I've caught largemouth bass on chronomid pupa and chronomid larvae.
Okay. Good. Another question off the internet, James in Bozeman, Montana. He says, fishing for very large trout in tailwaters and lakes, upper teens to 20-pound trout, what percentage of their diet consists of chronomids, or are they eating other forage fish exclusively?
You know, I think if you're fishing productive tailwaters like what you have in Montana, Wyoming, where the water's coming off out of the through the dam at a uniform temperature, you're talking about huge feeding concentrations on scuds, on shrimp. And, you know, in the lakes off, there would be trout that are feeding on chronomids. And some of those tailwaters could have very prolific chronomid hatches, but I think you have to remember, too, that while they'll eat them, and they do eat them, there's a question about that, the trout are always thinking about, if you're a trout, you want to feed on food sources where you expend the least amount of energy for maximum return. And so if it's a lot easier to feed on scuds or other bigger aquatic food sources, be it insects, other invertebrates, or minnow species, fish species, then that's what they're going to do. But if there's prolific populations of chronomids, certainly in the lakes that I fish, it's not uncommon to catch trout in the teens in weight, and you'll catch them on very small chronomid pupa patterns because they like to eat them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's talk about flies and patterns and so forth now. Martin in Lawrence, Kansas asks, what are some of the key attractors to fish when picking or tying chronomid patterns?
Yeah. So could you just, what are the different times?
The key attractors to a fish, I guess, like, you know, maybe beadheads or white gills.
Oh, sure. Yeah, so I think on your chronomid pupil patterns, you have to consider size that represents the size of the real ones, the color of them. The segmentation, I think, is important, that your patterns show segmentation because they are definitely segmented, and many of the most common chronomid species have prominent white gills at the spiracular gills at the tip of the head, and that can often be a very, I believe, a key trigger where the white gills stand out and the fish are zoned in on that. And then you want to keep your chronomid pupa patterns fairly slender. They're not plump flies, they're tapered, they have a very gradual taper to them, and with the materials that we have to tie today and the diversity of hooks, we can get pretty realistic as to what we're trying to imitate.
Don in Montana asks about the size of chironomids? What sizes do they span? You had mentioned this a few times before, but he says, well, you know, when you're trying to plan out tying imitations for both larva and adult forms, what sizes do the chironomids span, would you say?
Well, certainly, you know, that question, it's hard to have a generic answer to that, because in southwest Montana, still waters, the chironomid species could be quite a bit smaller than what I would experience on my local lakes. So you really need to spend some time on the water to kind of match, get an idea of what size and color that pupa and larva are. But it's pretty safe to say that certainly tying, when we get small, we're tying, you know, I'll tie down to a size 18 pupa all the way up to, you know, a number 8, sometimes even number 6 scudhook. But when I'm tying up, trying to imitate a number 18 or 16 chironomid pupa, I'll often tie that fly on a bigger hook. So I'll tie a size 18 pupa on a 16 hook, because at 18 hooks get pretty light, and if you hook a really big fish, you may be bending that hook out. So you can kind of tie them cheater style, where you're tying a small body hook, bodied fly on a bigger hook, and that's you can get away with that on those small flies.
Okay. We've got a couple people asking the same question here on the Internet. We've got David in Benton and Roger in Carlsbad, New Mexico. Also, Bruce, Hat Creek, California, all asking about the importance of color. And, in fact, Bruce says, you know, he uses zebra midges mostly in black, but he has other colors. He says when he switches colors, he doesn't think it makes much difference. So does it make a difference? And
I firmly believe in color. Okay. It's a huge difference, particularly when you're fishing clear lakes, clear-watered lakes, because depending on whether you're fishing clear water or tannic-stained or turbid water, yet a light penetration is different, and so colors will show up less or more depending on the clarity of the water. And trout are not colorblind, and so color can be very, very important, and that's why you need to have that little aquarium net with you, or use a throat pump properly so that you can sample the esophagus to get an idea of what size and color the fish are keying on. And, you know, color can be critical. Even the color of the rib, it can be down to the color of the rib that you're using on a fly. So you could be using same colored abdomen color, but the rib is slightly a different color, and then that could be the trigger that seems to produce more bites on that particular pattern than another one that looks very, very similar.
So we got a question from Ed in Kansas City. He asked about color as well, but he also asked how big a factor is the shine, the contrast, the bead. And when you use beads, because you said it sounds like you use a lot of beads, do you prefer clear, tungsten, brass, chrome?
So, yeah, certainly, again, bearing in mind the color of the lake that you're, of the water that you're fishing, certainly in clear lakes, you can be too bright. You can have too shiny of a bead, too flashy of a fly, and it's just not realistic looking, and you need to dull things down. So, for instance, if I was fishing a number 16 green chironomid pupa in an ultra-clear lake, I would be tying that pattern in both black bead head, a dull black bead, and then a white bead. And the white bead may be too bright some days on a bright sunny day, and you'll do much more effective fishing black bead or a dull-colored bead. It's just a little more drab, and it doesn't turn the fish off. Whereas if you're fishing an algae-stained lake or a tannic-stained lake, you know, a super white bead will help that fly stand out a bit. And certainly copper beads, black tungsten, work well for beads. Silver beads, a lot of guys tie using silver beads, silver metal beads, or even glass beads, using white glass beads as well, or clear holographic white clear plastic beads as well will work. So it all comes down to personal preference, but I think the bottom line is you want to get as close an imitation as the real bug, but bear in mind that if you're fishing ultra-clear water, flashy can be too much, and you have to dull things down.
So it sounds like it might be prudent to have a couple of versions of the same fly with a dulled-down head as well as a...
Oh, absolutely. Yep.
Yeah. And adapt.
On a lot, what I do on a lot of my pupil patterns, so, is I do coat the bodies, lacquer the bodies with something like Hard as Hull or a clear nail polish or Zappa Gap, which is like a crazy glue or a super glue. And that, all we want with that is that we're giving, lacquering that fly is giving that illusion of that trapped gas under there, and it also makes that fly much more durable as well. So it achieves two things.
The question came in on the internet here. Sunny up in BC as well, Salt Spring Island. He says, Brian, for size 16 and 18 grommet, very slim patterns, which tying threads lay nice and flat without a lot of bulk and will take colored Sharpie markers? He says, I already know the ones that don't work.
Certainly using threads, that's the way to get those ultra-thin bodies. Or tying the bodies out of, when you're tying small, tiny flies like that, you often tie the body right out of flashaboo or crystal flashes, and you can get a thin body as well. But certainly thread, and then marking them, coloring thread, you'll get that. And then adding some fine, ultra-fine wire for ribbing will really accent that fly off nicely.
So there's any particular kinds of threads that you prefer?
No, I just use, I'm using ADOT typically. I'll build those small flies out of things like ADOT or 6-0 uni thread, variety of different colors. And then again, you can brighten it up by lacquering those flies.
Okay. Do you use markers for, different colors?
Yeah, and you use markers to, a typical situation would be if you had a light brown abdomen and thorax of a fly, but they have a red butt because they have a little bit of hemoglobin still there, so you can use a marker just to darken that, the tag in of the abdomen to represent that hemoglobin.
Okay. Randy in Oregon wants to know about how important pattern size is relative to the actual size of the naturals. He says this topic often generates various opinions on forums. He's of the opinion that pattern size is not at the top of the list of importance. What would you say?
Well, here's a typical situation that you'll see on lakes. They'll be the first good chronomid hatches of the season start to come off, and they're small flies. They're 14s. Yet you can throw out a 12 or even a 10 on a scud hook and just catch a lot of fish. And I think that's because those fish are just starting to get on their chronomid binge for the year. And, they ate a lot of chronomids the year before, and they see that big one come down, and it's just a bigger food source, and they grab it. It's the right shape, right size, and it looked like a real chronomid, so they eat it. But as the hatches or emergences of chronomids intensify, those trout can get awful picky on size and color, and I think you want to be closer to the real size than just throwing out substantially bigger patterns, but of similar color.
Okay. Another question on the internet. Sarah in Livingston wants to know what you think of UV dubbing. Is it useful for chronomids?
Yeah, if you can use a bit of that UV dubbing in the thorax area, or UV, if you've got some white material for the gills that had UV in it. I like to use a lacquer that I've got that comes from the UK that has UV in the lacquer, and that's what I'll lacquer some of my flies with. And I believe in it, and the UV-coated flies certainly catch fish, and I don't see why you could build thoraxes up with some UV.
What's the characteristic of the UV that's attractive to the fish?
It, at depth, it makes that fly show up and stand out more.
Okay. Gordon in BC wants to know about if you have a preference for using small white beadheads or white antron to simulate the gills.
Yep. So in algal stain water, tannic stain water, it's particular just for sure. If you're fishing a lake that gets heavy blue-green algae blooms and you're using white antron for the gills, the gills can get plugged up with the algae when you're constantly bringing them up through the water column and casting them. And, 5 minutes after fishing that fly, the actual antron is staying green in color, so you're losing the effect of those flies of having the white gills. So, you know, when I'm fishing those tannic or algal-stained water or lots of algae, you know, I'll prefer to go to a fly that has a white bead head, a white metal bead head, a white, super white bead, and it just helps it stand out a little bit better, and it's certainly not going to get stained from the algae in the water. And in lakes that are clear, then, you know, you match the size of the bead to the size of your fly. You don't want a monstrous bead hanging out there. You want to keep the bead proportional to the body of the fly and the thorax, the abdomen of the fly. And white beads come in a variety of sizes in both plastic and metal.
You know, there's a, and this varies in Wayne, New Jersey. He says, I'm new to fishing chironomids, and he says, without knowing what bugs are living in the lake, what pattern should I use to start fishing? Looks like he's looking for a searching pattern for a chironomid. So let's talk about that for a minute. Maybe we see some birds out there, and there's some activity, and you think there's a hatch going on, so you see some chucks, but you really don't know what those larvae or pupa colors and sizes and shapes, and you haven't caught a fish yet to bump the stomach. Where do you begin?
It's my opinion that the most common pupa color is black. And so if you used a chironomid pupa pattern, black body, and then have them tied with red copper wire rib, regular copper wire, silver wire, and gold wire ribs, you would cover off, you know, a lot of generic or common pupil colors. Black is predominant, and then you want to have those different colored ribs, wire ribs, to fine-tune it. So red copper wire rib is a go-to color. Regular copper, gold, and silver wire are all good.
Okay. Dan in Arizona says, Brian, we're finding colors reverse in late season fishing, whereas dark chironomids with white head work best in the spring. White with black head is working best now. What is happening?
So I think the only explanation for that is that there's different species of chironomids coming off, and they're different colors.
Yeah.
And that's what the fish are on.
Yeah, not the same bug.
Right? It's just not the same bug.
Yeah. Pat in Laramie, Wyoming, says, when Kamloopsians, you know, that's a word, says they're catching them on black and red, exactly what pattern are they alluding to? What size hook do you think they are using?
I mean, as I just mentioned, you know, go-to color is black. The go-to, if I only had one chironomid to fish, regardless of where I was fishing, one chironomid pupil pattern, it would be, and size even, it would be a number 12 black-bodied chironomid pupil with a white metal bead and a red holographic tinsel rib, black and red. That's what we call a black and red. So a lot of anglers call black and red. It's just black body, red copper wire rib, black body, red holographic rib.
Okay, so now the secret's out, Pat in Wyoming.
Yeah, and you know what, and a 12 is pretty common, and if I was in Wyoming, I might do it on a 14, because it might be a titch smaller down there.
Yeah. Norm in Dublin, Ireland, I assume, says he read your book and saw plenty of leeches and scud patterns for cold water conditions, but no water louse patterns? Do you use water louse patterns?
So I'm assuming he's referring to sow bugs or shrimp with a water louse, because I don't know what else he'd be referring to. And so scuds, shrimp, our scud patterns we use would easily represent a sow bug, which we don't have in the waters that I fish. We have amphipods, scuds, hylella, and gammarus. And those flies or those food sources are available all year long, the trout, and are a staple food source. And if there were sow bugs in the lake, like they're common in spring creeks, they would be a very staple food source as well. And I certainly, you know, we certainly do use them.
Yeah, I just Googled water louse, and it shows, it says these are isopod crustaceans, and they got some pictures, and they look like a sow bug. Yeah.
So they're sow bugs, yeah. And we just don't have them here. But related to that would be, you know, the abundance of scuds.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, he could be fishing Norton could be fishing waters with a lot of isopods in them and or sow bugs, and yeah, it would be a very common food source and a very staple food source.
Well, Brian, as usual, we've run out of time and didn't get through all the questions. So,
no, we
but we covered a lot of material, so hopefully we've helped some people out with their chronomid fishing. I surely hope so. Time to cut things off and call it a night. Stick with me, though, for a few more minutes, Brian, because we're going to give away that book of yours, and Morris and Chan on Fly Fishing Trout Lakes, where I'm sure there's much more information about fishing still waters. So stick with me for a few more minutes, and we're also going to be giving away that one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine and also a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. So we'll be right back and do those giveaways just shortly. The Bristol Bay region of southwest Alaska is home to the largest runs of wild salmon on the planet and some of the best trophy rainbow trout fishing anywhere. The pebble mine still remains a threat to the region, and 2 million acres of federal lands may also be at risk. The entire fly fishing industry is united in this epic conservation battle. Anglers from across the country are joining the fight. Be one of them. Visit www.savebristolbay.org. That's www.savebristolbay.org, and there you'll learn more about how you can get involved. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave our website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section on tonight's show that says, what do you think of this show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away the prizes, and for the first two prizes, the winners are randomly selected from our show's registration database, and if you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for the next show so that you have a chance at winning some of these great prizes. And the first thing we're going to give away here tonight is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And if you're not familiar with the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org, a great international organization that helps support fly fishing and a great organization to be part of. And looking for a winner here, Ron Murray in D.C., Ron Murray in D.C., so a local yokel up there, it looks like. Do you know Ron?
Oh, no.
No, okay, all right. I know there's only 12 people that live in B.C., right? So,
yeah.
I thought you might know him. No, okay. Let's see here. Now the winner of that Fly Fusion magazine, which is out of Calgary, and that's Brian Benedict. Brian Benedict in California. So congratulations to the two of you for winning tonight. And I will send you an email and get your information so that we can get these memberships and subscriptions started for you. Now, give away your book, Brian. And to do this, we need to clear the queue here. People are going to submit their answers online here. And, okay. So, questions from what we talked about tonight. Let's talk about, you said that in the larval stage, a chronomid could, and this is a two-part question, folks, so hold on before you answer it. The larval stage, a chronomid could live for about or up to how long? And what was the one kind of unusual element in the terminal tackle that most of our fly fishers aren't used to using? What is the answer to those two questions? And let's see if we've got some people that were listening and how fast they can type. So I've started doing two-part questions because it's just these guys are too sharp out there and right away. So trying to make it more complicated for them.
Absolutely, yeah.
Ah, here we got somebody that's real fast here. I think he's got it here. You tell me, Brian. He says 2 years and the swivel.
Yeah, he's got it.
He's got it spot on there. Mark Hutchings in Provo, Utah. Congratulations. You just, you're the first one in and the first one with the right answer. And you're going to get Brian's book, Morris and Chan on Fly Fishing Trout Lakes. So congratulations. And Mark, what you need to do is either in that same text box you just typed in, send me your contact information, address, and we've got your email here. But send us your mailing address so that we can get that sent off to you, and Brian will get that sent to you directly, and we'll be good to go. You can also send it to info@askaboutflyfishing.com, info@askaboutflyfishing.com, and that'll get to me as well. Well, Brian, thank you so much for being on the show again with us tonight. It was a pleasure to talk with you as usual, and I had a great time, and of course I learned a lot, as I always do. But thanks for being with us.
Anytime, Roger. It was lots of fun.
Well, stay warm up there in BC, okay?
Yeah, I would. Yeah, we got
not about, easy. Easier said than
months,
done.
Yeah.
Pardon?
We got about 5 months of winter ahead of us.
Yeah. So, well, bundle up. Well, take care, Brian. Our next broadcast will be on December 7th at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, we'll interview Bo Beasley. And our topic for the show will be, how many menhaden do we really need and why fly anglers should care? Bo Beasley, an award-winning outdoor writer, will answer your questions on the importance of menhaden, also known as bunker, bogey, and fatback, in our coastal fisheries. These forage fish are eaten by almost every predator species in the sea and are threatened by overfishing. If you fish coastal river systems and saltwater coastlines from Texas to Maine, the fate of these crucial forage fish should matter to you. So tune into that if you're one of our East Coast fly fishers, and you'll learn a lot about these menhaden, an important part of our food chain for our predator fish. We'd like to thank Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Keys Fly Shop, Royal Gorge Anglers for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673 extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673 extension 8. And we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.